KOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, lovely folks like you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for news in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Street Roots reporter Jeremiah Hayden about the latest edition of the paper, out October 9th. It's the November general elections issue, part one. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, tell us about it. What all is in Street Roots General Election Issue Part 1?
Like you mentioned, this is Part 1 of 3 of Street Roots election coverage. There are a lot of candidates to get through in this election. I do want to start out giving a shout-out to Etta O'Donnell King. They are the illustrator at Street Roots, and they did a fantastic job of kind of laying this out and making, you know, what could be just a big brick of text from a whole bunch of candidates into something that's actually very interesting to read. So as you know, as a media organization locally, like, there are a ton of candidates due to the ranked choice voting and the new city council in Portland. So we have included in this issue, we have mayoral candidates, Portland City Council Districts 1 and 2, and then Multnomah County Commissioner Districts 1 and 2. And then our Part 2 and 3 will focus on other areas of the city.
How did Street Roots decide to approach covering this historic election in Portland?
Yeah, sort of, you know, you have to set a bar somewhere. And sort of, unfortunately, with elections being swayed so much by money, as the main sort of influence in elections, we kind of set the bar at candidates that had brought in enough cash to have to register a campaign finance account with the state. That was as of 2 months before voting day, because we started at that point. And then we sent out questionnaires. We hired in Tom Henderson, who's a longtime journalist in Portland and around the state, actually covers the legislature a lot. On contract to do a lot of these questionnaires so that we could still continue to focus on a weekly newspaper in this time.
And what was the focus of the questionnaires that you had folks answering?
We really wanted to be inclusive of our readership, so we actually sent out a survey a couple months ago to see what our readers are most interested in hearing from candidates. Being a social justice nonprofit newspaper, a lot of our readers wanted to hear about homelessness, housing policy, and environmental policy, because we do a lot of environmental reporting, and that is something that impacts low-income people, you know, disproportionately.
On a more meta level, I suppose, what do you think are some of the opportunities and challenges from a journalistic side of things when looking at this election?
Yeah, I think you and other folks at KBOO have been doing a ton of great work around this election. Probably acutely are aware of the challenges of this, but just the sheer number of people. You know, we got in touch with 122 different candidates. 59 of them responded, which, you know, is, you know, roughly half, but it's still a lot to sift through. So, you know, some of the challenges are just simply the time, trying to get people to respond. You know, StreetRoots opted to publish the questions and the names of the people who did not respond to us because, you know, we kind of believe that it says something, even if a candidate does not respond. So we wanted readers to be aware of kind of what we wanted to know and what people, you know, didn't have time for or just didn't want to respond to us. But, I mean, you know as well as anyone, and I think anybody who's doing any kind of reporting or following this election, city and countywide, like there's just a lot to sift through. One other challenge I'll kind of tack on here is this new ranked choice voting kind of allows for people to campaign together in a way rather than running against each other. They'll say that they're kind of running with someone. And I find it a little bit interesting and difficult to kind of distinguish sometimes as candidates tend to agree a lot more rather than kind of setting themselves apart. So you kind of get this sense that, you know, you can kind of rank anybody anywhere and a lot of that kind of ideas end up being a little bit the same.
Yeah, like you mentioned, through doing the Running on Air program at KABU, there is definitely a lot of coalescing around at least a handful of pretty popular ideas from a lot of different candidates across the different districts.
Yeah, as a nonprofit news organization, we can't really weigh in and try to, you know, we don't do any endorsements and we don't try to influence the election in any way as a rule. So a lot of our coverage is just very, very straight, just kind of this person said this person said that. And yeah, you're right. It doesn't allow for a way of saying, you know, like showing all of these differences so easily. And at the same time, you know, really like workable, you know, positive like solutions to what are happening in the city can really begin to reveal themselves as people kind of are repeating certain ideas, whether they're going to be kind of harmful ideas or whether they're good ideas. When people kind of coalesce around a thing, you really see the things that are rising to the top of what's possible.
And I think that's part of maybe the promise of the new government, the new system, the multi-member districts, the ranked choice voting, is that there is this more coalescing into the course of action as opposed to having, you know, different groups or things like that with a thumb on the scale.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. And you can see that in, like, you know, answers, you know, the kinds of questions that we asked for this coverage, you know, which is just like outside of private housing development to increase supply, how will you address the housing affordability crisis? You're going to get a really different answer from a candidate who is specifically focused on supply side with regard to, you know, impacting housing affordability versus someone who is kind of looking at some more kind of root causes and like social issues that lead people when people are homeless and not able to get into housing.
I will also just mention that having talked to a lot of candidates who've been coming through KABU, there's been, I think there's some of this that comes out from so many first-time candidates of like not really knowing what they ought to be doing. Should they be pursuing endorsements? Should they be filling out these questionnaires? And questionnaires are so important because they give you like a specific insight into, you know, what a particular readership or sometimes, you know, advocacy groups are doing them as well. Like, how does this candidate relate to what the priorities of our people are? But I have heard that they've gotten like hundreds of questionnaires and it's a lot of filling out questionnaires.
Yeah, I imagine so. That is something that I felt aware of as I would send these things out. It's like, hey, can you get this to me by, you know, tomorrow? we gave people plenty of time and follow-ups, but that is certainly with the understanding that we're probably not the only person contacting them.
So there were multiple reach-outs is what you're saying.
Yeah, I believe, you know, Tom handled most of this for, like, the legislature because he already does a lot of work there. Mayoral candidates, and he sent an initial email, and then a while back, month and a half ago, 2 months ago, and then sent like three follow-ups just to make sure people knew about it.
And for this edition, you reported on the Multnomah County races, which are those kind of one-on-one head-to-heads that we're more used to.
Right. I covered the Multnomah County Commissioner District 2. That's the Sam Adams and Shannon Singleton runoff. That's a really interesting race because in the May primary election, Shannon Singleton nearly got to the 50% needed to run away with that. But she was at 47%, I believe. So this is the runoff election. Sam Adams came in second with 26-ish% of the vote after beating out Jesse Burke, who is very kind of similarly minded, pro-business kind of interest. And so that, you know, Sam Adams is a very familiar name to a lot of people who have been in Portland for a long time. He has had a complicated history in local government and was rejected for his run at city council in 2021. Is that right? Yes. And then Shannon Singleton has a long history working as interim director at the Joint Office of Homeless Services, which has definitely come under fire recently from some more of the more conservative candidates in town. And she says she's ready to work on those kinds of solutions for people kind of opposed to camping bans, where Sam Adams is in favor of a countywide homeless encampment ban. So there's kind of some stark differences there, and I think that's one that you know, our readers and your listeners will be pretty interested in.
Looking at the whole issue, how do you hope that voters use this edition of Street Roots?
I mean, I think this is a really detailed guide, and it's a piece of, you know, the larger media landscape in town. I know that KBOO has been doing a ton of work around this. People can listen to those podcasts and find that, and there's a lot of really good in-depth coverage of people. I know X-Ray has done a lot of really good coverage. OPB has done a ton of great coverage. You know, there are people, you know, the Portland Mercury has, you know, pretty deep coverage of this. So this is something that people can really use, kind of put together with, you know, other resources to, you know, to find the candidate that works for them. If people are looking for a really easy, like, you know, Street Roots says this candidate or whatever, they're not going to find it. But, you know, in our newspaper. But I think these three issues are a pretty comprehensive look at what we have going on.
If listeners are interested in finding out more, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor in your neighborhood, and they accept cash, Venmo, and tips. I imagine a lot of them will be out in City Council Districts 1 and 2, Multnomah County Districts 1 and 2, and then also citywide for any mayoral races that people are looking at for our issue this week.
Oh, yeah. Forgot to mention the mayor's in there.
And the mayor, yes. We do have coverage from all of the mayor candidates that qualified for that, except for one commissioner, Renee Gonzalez, is a candidate for mayor, did not respond to our questions.
Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I really appreciate you having me, and thanks for all of your fantastic coverage as well.
Thank you, Jeremiah. And folks at home, stay tuned. Jeremiah may be joining us for an episode of Running on Air coming soon. That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about the latest edition of the paper out October 9th. It's the November general elections issue, part one. More to come in the coming weeks. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for listening.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. Tax havens are places with very low tax rates that enable multinational corporations and individuals to get around the law. These global havens have been responsible for depriving governments of billions of dollars in tax revenues. James Henry is an investigative economist and global justice fellow at Yale University. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg, who began by asking him about the most recent investigation he's been involved in.
The latest investigation we've been doing is of a couple big Swiss banks, the top two banks in the country, have merged. And
it doesn't have anything to do with the scandal that Credit Suisse had a few years ago.
Oh, yes. Well, we were deeply involved in that. Ralph Nader and I went to the Department of Labor in 2015. Credit Suisse had pled guilty to a corporate felony involving helping wealthy Americans take money out of the country. And under the provisions of the law, if you are advising U.S. pension funds, you have to declare any kind of conviction that you've had under U.S. law, and you're supposed to be ejected from the program for 10 years. But the Department of Labor has historically always given waivers to these big financial institutions that get convicted. And the two banks in question, UBS and Credit Suisse, the largest Swiss banks that are now merging, have accounted for about 14 of the 37 waivers that have been given historically by the Department of Labor. They have a virtually unblemished track record of giving waivers.
So is the Department of Labor one of those revolving door departments where people from the industry actually serve in the department? It doesn't seem like that department would be that way, but is it?
Yeah, I've been surprised. I mean, this was the Obama administration back then. We had a whole day-long hearing on Credit Suisse and talked about their criminal history, including their failure to, their reneging on their agreement with Holocaust victims. We had several survivors come in and testify about Credit Suisse never paying them under the 1990 agreement that was supposed to compensate the Holocaust victims for the amount of money that Swiss banks stole. But, you know, though they went on and gave them a waiver that year, and as we warned, institutions that have a track record of sort of serial criminality are really not likely to survive. And indeed, just last year, Credit Suisse hit the wall. They nearly failed. And the Swiss authorities decided to merge them into the other big bank, which is almost easily
equally criminal. Almost as bad.
And so right now, this very moment, we have a request for another public hearing. We've submitted a long comment letter. My international coalition, not only Nader, but also experts in Australia and Germany and South Africa and Kenya, who've seen Credit Suisse at work and UBS at work for decades, basically ripping off developing countries and making a business out of taking the capital flight back home. We've seen this time and again. Now they're before the Department of Labor again with another request for a waiver. So this is this is like an ongoing soap opera, but it's an opportunity, one of the few you get in the U.S. Power system, to actually have public hearings about the behavior of these big financial institutions. So we will at least have, this story will be told.
So if big corporations or wealthy individuals try to evade taxes by taking their money to, I don't know, Luxembourg or Bermuda or the Cayman Islands or one of those places, do the U.S. authorities go after them in a bigger way than with...
Well, they're supposed to, but basically the trend has been toward, you know, I would say a lack of enforcement. The IRS has cut its staff by about a third since 2012. There was a bill that Biden had passed to increase the resources so that the IRS could actually do more enforcement, including global enforcement. But generally speaking, you know, that's run into the Republican wall. And so they're really starved for resources. Secondly, a lot of this money is hard to trace. It's once it gets offshore, there's a lot of financial secrecy. And indeed, U.S. institutions have also become very secretive. I mean, one of the biggest recipients of dirty money is the United States, because we have financial secrecy just about as good as anything you can find in the Cayman Islands or the Isle of Jersey.
So the notion that tax havens are all offshore is really false.
Oh, yeah. No, the tax havens of choice in many cases are ultimately, I mean, you have to go through, you know, layers. There's about 141 jurisdictions that we consider to be financial secrecy jurisdictions in the world. When I started studying this topic back in the 1970s, there were 15. So this has exploded. Little companies, countries like you know, the Isle of Man and Mauritius getting into the business. But those are sort of the intermediate sort of stepping stones, the place that people really want to ultimately invest their money. The crooks of the world, the kleptocrats, the tax dodgers. It's a little bit like the Star Wars bar scene. You know, if you remember the Star Wars movie, all the crooks are sitting around the same basic facilities, making use of the same kinds of lawyers, the same lax regulation, the same low taxes. And ultimately, they want to get their money into a place with laws. So that's the irony. They want their investments protected. So they want to be in the United States. They want to be in Switzerland. They want to be in the UK. These are places that are, if you look at Transparency International's annual list of comparative corruption, you know, places like Switzerland, the United States, and the UK are always way, you know, we are way down the list in terms of corrupt places. You look at the African countries, they are the corruption. There's this notion of corruption being an indigenous characteristic. What we pointed out is that it's actually just the opposite. The enablers of this kind of kleptocratic system that we have are all first world countries. They're the ones with the banks and the law firms and the accounting firms that really make a business out of ripping off developing countries.
Do you have any idea, just looking at the U.S., how much revenue is lost because of these tax havens?
Well, if you divide it into a couple different categories, one is corporate tax dodging. And that has proliferated since the 1970s. A lot of companies like Apple, you know, had set up a company in Ireland to receive something like 60% of their global profits, basically as a citizen of nowhere for tax purposes. So it was a clever instrument that allowed them to park all this money offshore tax-free for decades. It didn't bring the money back. They wouldn't pay taxes. So corporate tax dodging, we figure, is on the order of $200 to $300 billion a year of lost revenue just from big companies that are doing that kind of thing. On the individual side, the numbers are at least that high. We're figuring something like $50 to $60 trillion of offshore private wealth that is essentially not taxed. That would include the money that's owned, you know, let's say in the United States by wealthy Russians who are not paying taxes here. So it's basically become a situation where more and more of the tax burden in the economy for unavoidable expenses like health and welfare and roads and policing and stuff like that are being borne by ordinary people, by the working class. We now have a regressive tax system in the world as a whole. And that's something that's a big reversal from when I first started working on this in the 70s. We had a progressive tax system, but that is pretty much out the window now.
So periodically, laws are passed by Congress to stop this kind of practice and to rein in these people. So what's going on there?
Well, you have 2,500 tax lobbyists in Washington, and they're not working for me and you. And so you have an IRS code, which has now got 75,000 pages of regulations. It's basically a full employment program for lawyers. You know, they've talked about a wealth tax as a possibility. I mean, I think that's a nice idea, kind of an armchair economics idea. In practice, it's very hard to tax wealth when you have, you know, billionaires who have free range on the planet and they can kind of move their money easily from one place to another. So if you slapped a wealth tax on someone with, let's say, you know, there are all kinds of valuation problems. How do you value a fellow's art collection? And, you know, and the unrealized portion of wealth is probably most of the wealth that's out there. It's like a full employment program for lawyers to set up a wealth tax.
So if the plan put forth years ago by Steve Forbes or brought back in another form, maybe I think Jerry Brown said it, we need a flat tax. And the idea I got there was that they were going to eliminate all the tax laws and just have this one flat tax. And of course, it would be regressive, but the idea was to just simplify the system and make sure that people really did pay their taxes. What do you think?
Well, I think it's possible to do a much simpler kind of income tax. We have all the structures in place to do a reasonable income tax. But there are other kinds of taxes that I think are relatively simple to implement. For example, New York State, since 1905, surprisingly enough, a Republican governor back in 1905 was facing a budget deficit. And against the opposition of everyone on Wall Street, he enacted a 0.1% transactions tax on stock trades. And everyone predicted that all of the stock exchanges would move to New Jersey. Actually, nobody moved. The tax was very successful. It operated well for 75 years. And then finally, Governor Kerry, who was in the pocket of Wall Street, repealed it. He actually didn't repeal it. He rebated it. So since 1982, New York State, which is a host to the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ Exchange, the two biggest exchanges in the world, has rebated to Wall Street, these, you know, sort of deserving poor on Wall Street, something like $500 billion that could have been saved by this tax. So we have a proposal now before the legislature, given the dire straits that New York City is in, to simply stop this rebate, to repeal this rebate of the 1905 tax. Well, of course, that would then clear the way for European exchanges and Asian exchanges to have similar kinds of financial transactions tax. And the whole thing could be a very good way of funding, say, climate change solutions. If we had a global financial transactions tax, that could easily raise $200, $300 billion a year without dropping a beat. I mean, it's a tiny tax per share of all the stock trade. There's something like $173 trillion of stock trades on the world's 85 stock exchanges now. So the idea of moving toward financial, you know, progressive sales taxes of various kinds is one alternative to the wealth tax. But I don't think there's any magic bullet here. It's a question of getting Congress to actually understand that we need better tax enforcement of existing tax laws. And there's some big obvious loopholes that can be fixed. And we can try some of these more innovative transactions-oriented taxes.
You mentioned in terms of government agencies or departments, the Department of Labor and the IRS. What about the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Commerce Department or the Treasury Department? What kind of role do they play in trying to stop?
Well, they can be very important. One of the important issues we face now is the emergence of crypto as an alternative. Just to step back, I mean, the way I got interested in the underground economy was back in the 70s, I noticed that there was something like four $100 bills per capita outstanding outside of banks and, you know, the United States, U.S. bills. And the question was, you know, where are they? Ordinary Americans, especially back then, did not walk around with four $100 bills in their pockets. They were barely seen. Now I think the figure is closer to 35 $100 bills per capita. And most of that money, it turns out, is offshore. So if you're an Argentine or, you know, you have a weak currency of your own, you would hold dollars. Now, the importance of crypto is that it provides, if it were widely established and it became a competitor to the dollar, it would become another, you know, sort of reserve currency. It would become a way of sort of keeping your investments away from the IRS. Very hard to audit that kind of stuff. So, you know, there's a whole issue now that the SEC has been involved in is how fast do they want to allow crypto? What are the constraints they're going to put on it? Basically, under Chairman Gensler, they've been fairly accommodating so far. Trump has said that if he's elected, he will open the door to crypto. Well, that's a sort of a license to for people to simply evade taxes. I mean, you have, you know, any
so is crypto kind of like high tech where the legislators and the regulators still need to catch up with it? They don't really know what's going on?
You know, I just don't think they understand the implications of it for these issues that we're talking about here. Because in terms of tax enforcement, if it becomes accessible to everyone and you can all have crypto wallets, right now, you can't buy anything with crypto. It's pretty hard to, you know, to use it to do grocery shopping. But as it becomes more useful to people and it's becomes also a store of value, it could become sort of a real threat to the traditional role of the dollar in the world economy and also a real headache for tax enforcement. So that's one aspect of this. U.S. Treasury gets involved in anti-money laundering. They have entities like FinCEN and the sanctions enforcement office that's involved in cracking down on entities that are violating sanctions around the planet. But when you take a look at all those agencies the Treasury has to enforce the rules against money laundering and sanctions busting, they are basically being starved for funding. I mean, I think the total budget for all of that enforcement effort in economic crime is less than $1 billion a year, and it's been declining since 2013. So again, we're seeing example, just like the Department of Labor, they've also been starved for money in this enforcement effort with respect to pension funds. So, you know, when they go after big banks that are criminals, basically advising U.S. pension funds, they are outgunned by the, you know, the Wall Street firms that are working for these big banks. And I think that's the real challenge. It isn't so much that we need more laws in the books. We need tougher enforcement.
That was investigative economist and attorney James Henry speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg about tax havens. You've been listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Mark Sanford Gross, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to KABU, KBOO, 90.7 FM, Portland.
Election season is here, and at KABU, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face